In the great hall of the Justice League, there are assembled the world's four greatest heroes, created from the cosmic legends of the universe. Superman, Wonder Woman, Batman, Aquaman, and those three junior super friends, Wendy, Marvin, and Wonder Dog. Their mission, to fight injustice, to right that which is wrong, and to serve all mankind.
Hello, and welcome to another exciting episode of For All Mankind, a Super Friends podcast. For All Mankind is a read-through show covering DC Comics' classic Super Friends series, which ran for 47 issues from 1976 to 1981. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Rob Kelly. And joining me this episode is my super friend, Scott X. Hi, Scott. Welcome to the Hall of Justice.
Hey, Rob. Thanks so much. You know, when my Justice League signal device went off and I got a message from you, one of the cosmic legends of the universe, I had to swoop immediately in, you know, to our great Hall of Justice here to join in the podcast. So thanks for having me.
Oh, absolutely. It's pretty good Ted Knight. You got the kind of basso profundo thing going on. That's great. So, of course, as I said, we're here to talk about, this is episode number 29. We're here to talk about Super Friends number 29, which was on sale November 20th, 1979. Now, Scott, you specifically asked for this issue, and that dovetails nicely into the question I always ask of a guest when it's their first shot, is what history, if any, do you have with the Super Friends comic book?
The Super Friends comic, this was the first issue of the Super Friends comic, one that I ever saw, and two that I ever bought. I was 7 years old when this comic came out. So, and of course, like many people, I'm sure that have been your guests on the show, you yourself and many of the listeners, I watched the Super Friends comic, or excuse me, the Super Friends TV show religiously. If I had misbehaved, my punishment was not to be able to watch the Super Friends. That's where that ranked in the pantheon of punishments, was to not watch the Super Friends. And I did sleep. I did, like Chris Franklin, sleep in the Super Friends sheets, the same Super Friends sheet set that he had. Not the exact same.
No, one. No, Chris. that would be weird.
That would be a little too friendly, probably, for my 7-year old self.
We're sending these to the Franklins. Oh, come on, Mom.
So again, we've talked about, or you guys have talked about that in the show before, the newsstand distribution was wonky back then. So you might see a comic and then never see it again. That was me with the Super Friends. This was the only issue I ever saw in my little town growing up in South Dakota. And when I saw a comic book that had the Super Friends, of course, I had to get it. And as the other reason I requested it was because I still have my original copy. So I pulled it out and reread this in preparation, and it's just lots of fun. You know, looking through it, seeing, you know, it really does put you back in the moment. I can look at the ads in the comic and the house ads and the letter columns and all that stuff, and it's just really been fun beyond the story itself, which we'll talk about, but just sort of that nostalgia of reading this comic again too has been wonderful.
That's awesome. What kind of condition is the comic in? I'm really curious.
Well, I would rate it at probably good. Okay. If I'm not going to give you the number. I don't get my cards graded and slabbed and all that. But I would say it's actually not bad. It's much better than some. There's an issue of, I believe, Superman. I can't remember the number that I have also won back from that era that at one time was apparently folded in four and placed in my back pocket that I still have that one too. But this one has fared much better over time.
Classic kid. This will never be worth anything. I'll just shove it in my back pocket. That's awesome. Well, that's great. Yeah, I mean, they said it's the vagaries of newsstand distribution. I talk about that on this show, and we've covered it on like Treasure. It comes up a lot, and Mountain Comics, because it's back in the day. You know, it doesn't make any real sense. You would think that if Super Friends sold well, they would bring it, you know, they keep getting it. I mean, you know, DC had a certain number of people who were in charge of those things, and you think they would be paying attention, to like, okay, we sold, how many did we send Joe's newsstand in South Dakota? Five. How many did we sell? We sold them all. Well, let's send them five more. You would think it would work that way.
Well, you would think, but I don't think it does. I think they just shipped them out and that was it. And if they sold, they sold. I asked that question not too long ago to a local shoe store. And because every time I would go to the shoe store, they'd be out of my size. And they say, oh yeah, we always sell them out, but yet you have four, you know, size 32s on the shelf. And I'd say, well, you know, wouldn't it make more sense as a business to actually get more of the ones you sell? And the manager just looks at me and says, yeah, you would think so. But corporate just sends us a set amount every month. That's it.
Wow. That is crazy. Yeah. You know what? Now that I'm saying it, I realize I deal with that myself. There's a drink that I like called we're going way off topic here, but the brand is called Bai, BAI, and it's like fruit flavored drinks. And there's no sugar, and it's all, that's why I like it. And they have this coconut lime flavor, which I dearly love. And the three supermarkets and the Target around here do not carry it anymore, even though every time they got it, I bought every bottle. So I was like, guys, I know you're selling out of this because I'm the one buying them.
That's right. And I would buy more.
Yeah. Like, guys, stop. Just get more of it. I'll buy every bottle. And then every store was like, no, we don't carry it anymore. I'm like, wait, it doesn't make any sense. So, well, I'm glad at least one issue of Super Friends made its way to
sell. Yes. Yes. That's exactly right. And like you, I bought it.
There you go. Exactly. So, plugged down that 40-cent super fast.
Or my parents bought it, probably. Yeah. I had probably, that was probably also in contrast to the, if I misbehaved, I didn't get to watch the Super Friends. But if I did something, you know, positive, I guess probably they bought me an issue of the Super Friends, the one that we saw.
Wow. Super Friends was carrot and stick in the
yes,
ex household. That's kind of amazing.
Yes, exactly.
So, okay, cool. All right, so we're going to talk about Super Friends number 29. There's two stories in this issue, a rarity that there's actually two stories here, and it's not a double-sized issue or anything, but they crammed in two stories in this comic. The first story is called Invisible Defenders of Earth. It is, of course, by E. Nelson Bridwell, Ramona Freyden, and Bob Smith, who is back on the inking for after skipping last month's issue. Thanks so much there, Bob. Before we get to the story, what do you think of this cover? We've got an invisible Wonder Woman lassoing the invisible Super Friends.
Well, I will look at it two ways. 7-year-old me saw this and said, "What? The Super Friends are disappearing." You know, why is Wonder Woman doing that? So it obviously pulled me in. I like the cover. Even just sort of bizarrely, it has a little bit different perspective or angle. It's sort of a low angle looking a little bit upwards, which I like. And I always like those, how they choose to do the renditions of invisibility in art. I find that interesting. And I don't know, I guess beyond that, I like the cover.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I'm always happy when, you know, all five of the team are on the cover. Because, you know, generally, sometimes they lack a space. You cut it down to three, and we all know who always gets cut generally in that regard.
Right.
But yeah, Ramona Freyden finds a suitable angle to where we can fit everybody in. And then there's a little blurb about the Wonder Twins getting their own feature down at the bottom. So, you know, she doesn't have a lot of space, but her and Smith pulled off. It's a striking cover. I just think it looked great all together like that.
And like you said, you know, in this particular issue, and we'll talk about that as we get there, there was no need to put a well-known villain on here either.
Just
it wasn't really in this story, so the heroes could really be the stars of the cover or featured on the cover.
Exactly. All right, so let's get to the plot of this one. The Wonder Twins are visiting Wonder Woman while she is on monitor duty on the JLA satellite. Suddenly, a message comes in from an alien ship telling them that these beings plan on taking over the Earth, so they should surrender immediately. Wonder Woman responds to this the way you'd expect. The aliens have a beam that claims it has the ability to destroy any and all visible life on Earth. Once one of their ship lands, Wonder Woman is there to meet it, except she uses her magic lasso to vibrate the exposed parts of her body into another dimensional plane. The other Super Friends arrive, and she does the same for all of them. Since all the Super Friends' eyes are in the other plane, they can't see what they're doing. So they need the Wonder Twins, who are monitoring from the JLA satellite, to tell them what to do and where to go. Despite having to fight the aliens essentially phonetically, the Super Friends manage to subdue them, which allows Wonder Woman to return them all to the same dimensional plane. Since the visiting alien ship has kryptonite inside it, Wonder Woman takes the lead and smashes her way into it, destroying it. Superman carts the wrecked ship back to its mothership, and the Wonder Twins tell the alien leader to Amscray. He tucks his antenna between his legs and orders the ship to depart. The Wonder Twins initially feel sorry that they weren't part of the fight, but Batman reminds them that they were the eyes and ears of the Super Friends. So obviously this is an abbreviated tale because, as I said, this is not a double length issue. It's a normal page count, but we've got a Wonder Twins story to get to. So this is a very brief story. What did you think of it overall, Scott?
I liked it. It was definitely the Super Friends, meaning you, and I know you've talked about this 100 times. I could totally see this as one of the episode shorts on the cartoon. We sort of have this no-name villain. The five primary Super Friends they're in this one. You know, they all sort of have their little part to play. And that's about it. It was just wonky enough to be the Super Friends. Like, Wonder Woman can swing her lasso around and move individual body parts to another dimension. Okay. That's, again, chalk that up to the Super Friends powers that are not really powers, it seems like. The aliens were just sort of I thought sort of nondescript, but sort of interesting looking anyway. Ramona Fraiden did a nice job with them. And I just kind of like the idea of the Wonder Twins helping out without being directly involved in the battle, too.
Can you cast your mind back to 7-year-old little Scotty X and imagine what he thought of the story? Is this the kind of thing that you probably just would have been like, awesome, because I know there was elements to it that you would have liked, or would you have been like, oh, I wanted a villain as opposed to some generic alien? Did you have those kind of specific tastes that you liked about superhero comics back then?
Well, I mean, I think to me it just was an episode of the Super Friends, so I was good with it. I never really thought anything different about it because it was the only Super Friends comic I'd ever seen. So to me, and I know you've talked about this in the show before, you know, you kind of felt like it was just another part of the Justice League or whatever. I always thought the Super Friends, I felt they were distinct from the other. This was the Super Friends. That was the Justice League. They were different. I don't know why my mind went there. So this was just a Super Friends comic. But I will tell you, my favorite thing in this whole comic was when they show the other dimension. It's sort of like this weird color thing, and just Batman's mouth is there. That, you know, like, his eyeballs aren't there, which, and Robin sort of has his head with, like, this thing with his mask, but, and I remember even as a kid thinking that was pretty weird, where just his mouth was there.
Yeah, I'd be right. Agreed. As you said, this could not have filled 23 minutes of a Super Friend show, but when they were doing that hour-long show, and it was three segments. It was like Super Friends and then Wonder Twins and then the weird team up, you know, right. Batman and Rima the Jungle Girl. You're like, what the hell? Batman and Rima the Jungle Girl. But though that initial segment didn't have to be 23 minutes, it was like 15 or 14.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, this you could get 14, you probably could have gotten 14 minutes out of. And yeah, I mean, obviously it's an 11 page story or something like that. So, I mean, E. Nielsen Bridwell was already not even 11 pages, 9 pages.
Nine pages.
I mean, again, that's the kind of thing that, you know, as they say, separates the men from the boys, is being able to write a story with a beginning, middle, and end in 9 pages featuring 7 characters plus an antagonist. I mean, again, that's something. Now,
I was going to say, I found it interesting, too, in the letter column of this one. There was a letter. It was not about this issue. It was about issue 24, but they talked about, by the way, almost every letter in there was either liking the fact that Aquaman appeared a lot in that particular issue and then wanting more Aquaman down the road. So I felt like the spirit of Rob Kelly was in every letter in this particular issue. But they talked about, or Bridwell responded to one of the letters saying how they always start with the plot. They never make any effort to make one of the characters the star. They start with the plot. They don't figure out who the villain is. They said, after we have the plot established, we decide who's best going to fit this particular story, both as a villain and as the so-called featured hero, which I found that was interesting. Just as again, how do you do that in 9 pages versus a longer story, too?
Yeah, seriously. Yeah, regarding Aquaman, I think us Aquaman fans are a complainy bunch. At least we were at the time. Pre-movie. We were, you know, we want to defend him. So, yeah, I think that there was probably a disproportionate amount of letter writers. They're like, hey, get Aquaman in this book a little more. So I love the splash page at the JLA satellite. It is sort of funny to think when you're a kid, you sort of accept these things that, of course, all the JLA members have to, you know, share monitor duty. And you're like, what a waste of Wonder Woman sitting for. And like the monitor shifts were like 24 hours, which I think is violating some HR laws.
Yeah.
On top of that. But it's like, what a complete waste of Wonder Woman's time to be sitting staring at a monitor for 24 straight hours. Well,
and then you figure, what happens when some big crisis comes up? Oh, I got to leave. Okay, now the monitor is empty. So yeah. We're going to have a distraction crisis here where somebody just sort of, no, Superman isn't available. He's on backup monitor duty. So he's got to go up there and sit now while the other crisis is going on.
I guess you get that bird that, like, you know, pecks at things because it's weighted. It just keeps bobbing back and forth to get that bird to do it or something.
They just flip on Computo.
Yeah, right, exactly.
He's going to take over on that automated duty for a while.
Exactly. So I do love the alien race design with its metalized antenna sticking out of its head.
You know, the first thing I thought about, and I would have never thought of this then, but it's sort of a headgear. For those of you that watch Doctor Who, it's sort of a Davros-looking headgear, kind of with this circular thing with rods going into his head. So that's, as I look at it now, I'm like, oh, that sort of looks like that.
I have no idea what that means, but I will take your word for it, Scott.
My word for it, Rob.
So again, I like that he's magenta, this kind of straight up magenta, you know. Yeah. A lot of these aliens that were in these comics and these remind me of the aliens from issue number 27, which you talked with Chris Franklin about. They all look like Filmation aliens. They all have that came kind of. The Bimfabs, that's always the name I remember, the Bimfabs. We are the Bimfabs, Aquaman. They all have that same kind of approach. So then, you know, Wonder Woman goes down to the planet, goes down to Earth. And yeah, I got to say, when I got to that point where she's like, oh, I can just vibrate my body into another dimension. And I was like, she can? When is that a thing? Now, what I know about E. Nelson Bridwell, though, the man tied everything in. That was his, like, reason for existence. So if that happened, that's because Wonder Woman did it in an issue of, like, Wonder Woman from, like, 1947 that
I was going to say, yeah. Well, and again, like I said, not only did they vibrate into another dimension, only the parts that were not covered by clothing went into the other dimension.
Exactly. So
it was very specific, which was sort of the thing, you know, where the aliens were coming because they were overpopulated, so they were going to come colonize Earth, so in order to colonize Earth, their super ray or whatever was going to destroy all life on Earth that was exposed. That was their big plan. So they, you know, so that was why Wonder Woman had to do that, of course, just only the exposed part. So, of course, as I reread this, and as a kid, I didn't even think about this, of course. I'm like, well, why don't they just go get those diving suits that they wore like a couple of years ago? You know, I mean, instead, they're all coming there and Wonder Woman says, oh, I have to do this. You know, maybe she'd have given them a heads up and just kind of said, hey, you know, we're put on your diving suit when you come.
Yeah, I mean, thank God they didn't run into Spider-Man because he would have been fine. You know, he would have been completely fine. Yeah, Wonder Woman, you know, all the super friends show up and Wonder Woman does the same trick on all of them. And I say I really do love the, as you mentioned it, the interdimensional space.
Yes,
it's all just crazy colors. Yep. And now it's designated with ink lines. So that had to be the work of Fraden and Bob Smith. They had to choose because you even see there's some black spots there. So that was that was drawn and inked. It wasn't all just the work of Adrian Roy. But nevertheless, Adrian Roy gives it like this kind of fruit stripe gum kind of look to it, which I just think is really cool looking. And I look at it, I'm like, boy, I wish they had done this on the cartoon, because that would look boss, you know.
And I envision this, and again, the way it's drawn, it expresses movement. Like these colors are swirling too. In my mind, I see them swirling and moving, and as you go from panel to panel, it just looks like it moves. The shapes are different. The dimensions look different. The dimensions of the dimension, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. It's a really cool effect. I really like the combo of, again, Fraden Smith and Adrian Roy. So then once the Super Friends have to get into they have to fight these aliens again with the Wonder Twins telling them kind of where to go and stuff. And, you know, as we know, this is a kid's comic. It was never going to be too violent, even though, as we talked about just a couple issues ago, there was those crooks that managed to try and murder Superman five different ways, blow him up with a grenade and stab him with it, whatever. But, like, I love on page 7 that the panel, and you'll see some of these pages on our website, of course, findwaterpodcast.com, Batman punching the alien in the chin.
Yeah.
so hard that he's lifting the guy off the ground a little bit. That's just a well-constructed pose. And you really feel like he probably broke that guy's jaw by that, with that punch.
That panel was stuck in my head for the last 40 years or whatever. Because I totally remember that panel, exactly what you're talking about. And again, the way she draws it, kind of with the motion lines of his arm, you know, flexing up into the guy's chin. I mean, you can see he's swinging with some oomph there.
Yeah, it's great. And then Aquaman does the same thing in the panel right below it, where he punches one of the guys right in the nose.
Yeah.
And again, Frayden was so good at movement that her, kind of like Jim Aparo, that when they would draw a punch, it looked like it landed with severe force.
Yeah, and it looks like he kind of collapsed the guy's face, too.
Yeah, exactly.
If you really look at it, it looks like he literally collapsed his face. So.
I love it. It's great.
Yeah, and you know, and I have to laugh at their plan you had talked about in previous issues that we've seen. You know, how they approach, for a kid's comic, I hesitate to say violence. It is violence, but it's not overt violence. With the exception of the overall plot, is the destruction of all life on Earth is sort of the potential outcome here. And then, of course, the Super Friends defeat them. And they're chastised. The aliens are chastised by Zan and Jaina. You know, you are advised to abandon Earth at once, and Superman is standing by to make sure you do. And the alien responds, "Well, we'll seek elsewhere for a planet, one that's already not inhabited." Yeah, that might have been a good thing to think of before you tried to destroy life, all life on another planet to colonize your own.
Yeah, did you guys not think that through at all? I mean, I don't, you know, yeah. Whatever.
We really like your planet so much that we're going to destroy all life on Earth to come colonize it.
Yeah.
Versus just finding an uninhabited planet from the start.
Okay, thanks, guys. Again, much like
damn
the aliens.
Bureaucracy.
Yeah, really. I mean, seriously, it's like from the alien from issue 27. It's like, didn't anybody think to check about this? And so I just love the idea that you know, Superman will be checking up on you guys. Like, okay. Sorry. And then it ends with the little, it's not a moral, but it's like a little thing that the Wonder Twins are like, oh, we didn't get to be part of the mission. And of course you were. You helped us punch those guys' lights out. Yep. So there you go. Thank you very much.
Everybody's role is important, which is, it's just sort of cool. You know, your role was just as important.
Absolutely. That's a good lesson to teach kids. So, as we mentioned, there's a whole second story, in this book. It's the Wonder Twins get their own solo feature. Now, this isn't the first time. Obviously, they did the origin story back in number 14, I believe, when I had Mark Russell, who wrote the Wonder Twins series, on that issue to talk about that story. So here, we're going to learn how the Wonder Twins ended up sort of becoming part of Earth society here, thanks to Professor Nichols. Now, this story is called Scholars from the Stars, and it's by Ian B. again. This time, Kurt Schaffenberger does the pencils and Bob Smith does the ink. So Ramona kind of got a little bit of a lighter load this month. She didn't have to draw the whole book. So flashing back to the time when the Wonder Twins went to live with Professor Nichols, he tells them that they need to establish human identities. So Jaina changes into a blonde and Zan uses a chemical spray that does that trick for his hair. Zan and Jaina, now as John and Joanna Fleming, enroll in high school. Their classmates ask about their past, but the Wonder Twins are elusive in their answers. One of the high schoolers, Lou Ruskin, decides to tail them after school. Zan and Jaina notice Lou is tailing them, so they decide to give him a show. They disappear down an alley, and Lou follows, and he sees a penguin sitting on a block of ice. Lou asks another classmate to check it out, but when she does, the penguin and the ice are gone. Lou thinks he's losing his mind, of course not noticing the flea and dewdrop chortling to themselves. Another classmate tries trailing John and Joanna, only to find a talking hippo and a snowman when he tails them. A third classmate tries the same thing and is met in that same alley by a mermaid floating in a pool of water. The only one of the group who hasn't tried tailing the Wonder Twins, Ellen, figures something is up. She waits around the corner and overhears John and Joanna laughing at their repeated pranks. When she hears them discuss Exor, she wonders what that even means, when suddenly a snake rounds the corner and grabs her by the leg, causing her to run off. Except, of course, it's not a snake. It was Gleek's tail. The Wonder Twins think they've gone too far and turn to Professor Nichols for help. He gives them an invention he's been tinkering with, a small handheld holographic projector. John and Joanna show it to their classmates to explain all the weird stuff they've been seeing. When Ellen confronts them about Exor, the twins say they were born in a town in Sweden called Exjo, and John and Joanna are the Americanized versions of their Swedish names. Mollified, the kids agree to help John and Joanna learn more about their new country. All right, so Scott, what did we think of Scholars from the Stars?
I as a kid, I loved this story because I learned that the Wonder Twins didn't just always hang out in the Hall of Justice. They actually had secret identities, which I thought was cool. And even then, I thought it was hilarious that Jaina used her powers to say, shape of a blonde, which I thought was hilarious. Yeah, interesting. And I don't know, I liked it. It was simple. It was sort of funny. It was no earth-shattering, you know, introspective tale here. And I learned that Kurt Schaffenberger draws a quite appealing topless mermaid as well.
Seriously, yeah.
In this comic. So I liked it.
I will say, you know, having to sit here and write the synopsis, I got really, which of course, you know, E. Nelson Birdwell was not imagining some nerd, whatever was ever going to do 40 years later. But I did get very irritated at the repetitiveness of it.
Yes.
That it's like, okay, the first kid, Penguin and Ice. Second kid, you know, Hippo and Snowman. Third kid, the third one, like, okay, I get it now. Like, okay, we did, you know, it's like maybe these kids should stop trailing them down this alley or something. Like maybe that, you know, whatever. But yeah, oh, that's such a ridiculous criticism to lob at this story. It's just meant to be kind of silly. And like we said with the previous story, you could see this being a segment on the cartoon, except there would have to be some sort of danger that the kids were really in, because that was the Wonder Twins shtick, is the kids were
right.
These other kids were always doing something stupid, like setting a fire or joyriding or right, or whatever. Right. These kids are more just nosy because, of course, you know, Zan and Jaina are kind of giving weird answers. Yeah, I do. I thought it was funny that, you know, when they get to the mermaid sequence, Kurt Schaffenberger had to, you know, play fast and loose a little with the staging, because obviously we can't have a topless woman in the Super Friends comic. So yeah. We just see her from the back. You know, although I will say art wise on that same page, right? The panel below, where the younger woman, not Ellen, she's the one who kind of figures everything out at the end, but the other girl, I forget, I'm putting her name at the moment. Her, when she's like, you wouldn't believe it because I don't think I did. That face is really well drawn.
I mean, it is. Yeah.
It is like top level emotionality on a face for such a silly story. I mean, Schaffenberger, man, really bringing it.
Well, he did a lot. I mean, he did a lot with facial expressions in this. You know, I mean, there was in the top on that same page, the top corner panel too. You know, it was just sort of that look of surprise that girl had, which I think is the same girl. And then she comes back down here, and again, just sort of the panel that you described, her eyes are closed and she's sort of looking down, and it conveys so much emotion with so
little.
It
really does.
With little even emotive drawing. It was very simple and subtle, but it really worked.
Yeah. I mean, Schaffenberger was one of those guys I've said before that when I was a kid, I didn't like as much because I thought it was too cartoony and too simple. But as I've gotten older, I've really come to appreciate just the, like, you know, really crisp draftsmanship of his, and his facial stuff is like second to none. There's a, I don't even know where I saw it. It's somewhere. Mike Bailey, I'm sure, can, or Henry Bernstein, any of the Bob Fisher, any of the Superman fans out there can pin it down. But there's like a, there was like a model sheet that he drew for Lois Lane, and it was like 20 Lois Lane heads of different emotions. And you're like, God, every one of these heads looks like Lois Lane. Like, it's spot on, you know, Lois annoyed, Lois angry, Lois surprised, Lois happy. And it was like, that takes with like very few lines. So, I mean, man, yeah. I mean, again, not news to anybody. Kurt Schaffenberger knew how to draw, you know, okay. You know, but man, he, again, for such a kind of a goofy story, he really does a great job. Now, of course, if I was these kids, and they were like, oh, our friend gave us a projector that makes holograms look real, I'd be like, wait a minute. Okay. What are you doing to me here? I saw the water that my legs were in. What are you talking about? But, you know, nobody said these are like the sharpest kids in these high school, in this high school.
Yeah. And it's the Super Friends. That's just that you just, you know, it's just like, as always, there's just certain things you just sort of accept and you go with it. And that's the beauty of these stories versus some of the other, you know, we're joking about some of this stuff, but the fact is when I read the Super Friends, I don't worry about any of that plot stuff that sometimes you know, plot inconsistencies or little inconsistencies. I don't worry about those much as in the Super Friends comic. And that's sort of why, even as I've gotten older, I love the comic even more. I don't feel like I have to be bogged down with overthinking stuff that I do, I feel like sometimes, you know? I just can enjoy it for what it is. It's a simple, sort of goofy story that's meant to be fun. You know, everything gets so dark now and everything else, and tries to always, I hate to say tries to tell a story, but, you know, tries to have, I don't know. They sometimes just get too deep and dark for me now and too convoluted. Sometimes I like a break, and just this simple stuff, it suits me just fine.
I understand. Now, so again, since you're new to the show, like, what's your general view on the Wonder Twins? Like, are you kind of like, I don't need a Wonder Twins solo story? Or are you more like, oh, no, that's cool. Wonder Twins get a solo story.
I'm all for it. And I partly because I think they're treated much better in the comic than they were on the cartoon, as I think many of the characters are in some ways too. So I was all for it. Like I said, when I was a kid, I loved this story because I got to see more of the Wonder Twins in a totally different way. So I'm all for it. I'm good with it.
This is not the last. I generally haven't been reading ahead, but this is not the last Wonder Twins solo story. Eventually, DC would start doing regular backups in the Super Friends comic, where the Wonder Twins would change with different slots with the Global Guardians and then Plastic Man, and then they would kind of rotate around. But so if you enjoyed this Wonder Twins story, this will not be the last one. So our roundup is The Best Friend. Now, of course, it doesn't really come into question on the second story, but in terms of the first story, I think it seems relatively obvious who the best friend is in terms of who came off the best in the opening story.
That's Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
For me. She's the one that she first got the message from the alien. She stood up to them. She devised a plan. She implemented a plan. And in the end, she was the one that trashed their ship and sent them packing. So it's Wonder Woman.
Yeah. It's gotta be Wonder Woman. This is everything. She gets pretty much, she discovers the problem. She comes up with a solution to the problem. And then when Superman can't get into the ship because it's got kryptonite, Wonder Woman steps in, which she should have done in Batman versus Superman Dawn of Justice, by the way, but that's a whole other argument. I love the panel of her smashing the alien ship again. Yeah. Perfectly drawn by Ramona Freedom, her just going in there and just wailing on just smashing the crap out of this alien
and ship. I like the panel before too, where it sort of shows her. You know, she says, like, there's kryptonite in that thing, Superman, so this will have to be a job for Wonder Woman. And she kind of leaves the other super friend standing, and she runs in there, too. And then she goes in and trashes them. Which I did also like that, how at the beginning of when the aliens first got there, they basically said, well, don't bother having Superman do this, because there's kryptonite here. You know, they kind of sort of gave it away right away, too, that there was kryptonite in there.
I feel like Superman and or Wonder Woman are constantly giving the other super friends like that cake from the Simpsons gif where it's like, at least you tried kind of thing. It's like, all right, thank you. You know, all right, that's great. So overall, like I said, yeah, it's a fun issue. The Wonder Twins, I can kind of take or leave. And so I'm like, do I need them in a solo story? Do I need more of these? Maybe not. I'm perfectly happy with a full length super friend story. But nevertheless, for 9 pages, it's in, it's out, it's fun, and it's got a lot of visual life to it, of course, by Fraden and Smith. So you can't beat that. So overall, really fun issue.
Absolutely. And again, I can't help but look at this through the lens of my 7-year-old self, too. So, you know, I love this this issue, so I maybe think more of it than others would, but I'm good with that. This is my 7-year-old self rereading this and just loving every minute of it.
Nothing wrong with that, Scott. I mean, I unironically call Justice League of America number 200 the greatest piece of literature in Western civilization.
Yes, I mean, I am very well aware, Rob.
There just might be some nostalgia coloring my view of that book. I don't know. That's for other people to judge. But no, nothing wrong. There's something. I mean, God, I have a whole series, Mountain Comics, about my beloved childhood comic book purchases. So, I mean, believe me, I'm totally there. And so, if you're a Super Friends fan, and you're like, oh, wait, there was a... Now, can you... This meme, you may not be able to remember this, because obviously it's a long time ago, but, like, were you aware that there was a Super Friends comic from ads, or did you not even know that that existed? Oh,
no.
Wow, so...
I had no idea until, like I said... I was 7 years old, I wouldn't even know where I probably got it. I have a suspicion that it may have been while I was visiting my grandparents in their local grocery store, but I'm not sure about that. So I never knew there was a Super Friends comic until I had seen it. Not that I recall.
Wow.
Not that I can recall. This was, I saw it and was like, oh, wow. And, you know, you had a handful of ones, and that was the one I picked. Because when we got them, you know, we didn't have a lot of comics. We watched the Super Friends on TV and Spider-Man on TV and even Spider-Woman, the Fantastic Four, the Hulk, all those cartoons that were around that time. But to have a comic for me was a real treat. So usually when we went, they'd have the comics sort of on the little stand there, wherever you were, or in the rack, and we got to pick one. And when I say we, I mean me and my brothers got one.
Mm.
So it was the shared comic as well. So, and we would have picked it. Right. So that was a big deal.
All right. Well, that's really exciting though. I mean, if you didn't know the comic existed, and then you're like, what? There's a, it's a Super Friends comic. I didn't
know
that.
And it had the Wonder Twins in their own feature. You know, they were two Titanic tales.
Yeah.
It's right on the cover. So,
absolutely.
You know, I figured, of course, in my brain, I'm thinking like two stories, you know, awesome.
40 cents. Yeah. Good deal.
Granted, I wouldn't in my little head probably didn't think about, oh, they're cutting each of them in half.
Right.
They're two shorter stories, but I got two stories.
That's a good deal. Did you watch the Super Friends until the very end? Till it went off the air?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I was watching the Superpowers. I watched all of them. All
Galactic
the way
Guardians, the whole
Galactic
bit.
Guardians. Yep. I was in it till the end. Absolutely.
All right. Fair
and
enough.
And Shag will love this. Firestorm was my favorite on the Galactic Guardians and those Superpowers shows. Those were my favorite at that time.
The best thing about that is he's not listening, so he'll never hear that.
I know he's not.
Yeah, exactly. He doesn't listen to my shows. So anyway, Scott, I mean, as always, man, it's always a delight to talk to you. You've been on, I think, almost all of my – well, you haven't been on Pod Dylan, but you've been on Fade Out twice. You're the only repeating guest on Fade Out so far. You've certainly been on Film and Water. Have you done Treasury Cast? I can't remember.
No. But I need to do a Treasury Cast.
Yeah, we got to get you on Treasury Cast. All right, yeah, we got to get you on that. All right, let's write that down. Okay, well, cool. Again, thank you so much for coming on, man. And thank you for – I'm glad that this issue – like, there's an issue of Super Friends that's, like, a big part of your comic book childhood. So that's
absolutely. Awesome. Big part of my personal comic book history. So thanks very much, Rob, for letting me come on and share that with you.
Absolutely. Why don't you tell people where they can find you out on the internet?
Mostly you can find me on Twitter. My handle is @TheMindOfScottX. Where I occasionally tweet about things, comic book, pop culture, and usually live tweet Sven Gulli on whatever crazy movie they're having on Saturday nights. Also, along with that, the episode of Star Trek, the original series, and probably other things as well, too, depending on how late I can stay up in my old age.
It's getting harder and harder.
Yeah.
So, once again, Scott, thank you so much for coming on. And everybody, thanks for listening. I want you to stay tuned. I'm going to play some podcast promos and some commercial announcements. And when I come back, I'm, of course, going to do some listener feedback.
Hey, Ryan, I know we're taking a break from Batman Nightcast, but I've been thinking about the Nightfall storyline, where Jean-Paul Vallée temporarily took over the role of Batman.
I see where you're going with this. If you were ever paralyzed, I would be honored to take care of Cindy and your kids.
No, that's not where I was going. I was thinking about all the many characters who have filled in for Bruce Wayne as Batman over the years. Dick Grayson, Tim Drake.
Commissioner Gordon, for some reason.
Yeah, that did happen. Anyway, on the subject of temporary replacements.
Your son Andrew is going to take over Supermates?
No. Focus on Batman. Why is this so hard? While we're away from Nightcast for a while longer, someone could come in and do a Batman-related show for the Fire and Water Network.
Well, I know Paul Keen loves the Batman Family comic book.
I've seen Sean M. Myers post a few things about Batman Family, too.
Do you think they'd...
We'll do it! For those of you who aren't familiar with the series, Batman Family was a DC comic that ran for 20 issues from 1975 to 1978. And then rescued Detective Comics from the DC implosion by continuing as a dollar comic for 15 more issues until 1980.
The title started out with new features starring Batgirl and Robin, along with reprints before morphing into all new stories starring other members of the Batman family, such as the Huntress, Commissioner Gordon, Man-Bat, and even Ragman and the Demon.
So you're all invited to the Batman Family Reunion Podcast, taking over the Batman Nightcast feed.
Coming in January to the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
This could be the sensational podcast find of 2022.
It's a beautiful day for digital derby, ladies and gentlemen. Tommy Hill starts out cautiously. He jams his car to second gear. Now third, he's really moving. The traffic is tight, but Tommy Hill's in the lead. Look out, Tommy! Too bad. Tommy Lee Hill's out of the race. Tommy, you had a rough time out there. What happens now? Will you retire?
Retire? I'm only 8 years old.
Oh, yeah.
Batteries not included. Digital Derby Auto Raceway comes complete with lap counter and timer by Tomy.
And it's time for listener feedback. And these are the comments we got on the website, finewaterpodcast.com, for the previous episode of For All Mankind, issue number 28, with my guest, Dr. Jennifer Schwartz-Levine. First up is David Gallagher, who get well soon, David, who says, such a classic and is such a glorious cover. Been waiting for this issue. Well, David, I hope it lived up to all that anticipation. Gus Casals says, another great episode. And, of course, Dr. Jen elevates all podcasts she's featured in. Maybe it's time to give Jenny tenure. Wink, wink. Love both the cover and the splash so much. I know we shouldn't still be reading things this way. But good thing Bruce and Dick had dates, because if the billionaire brought his same-sex minor ward as his companion to a date, well, you know. Speaking of parties, I have done the costume thing several times as Superman, as Mr. Incredible, including dyeing my hair for realism, and as the Eurythmics era Annie Lennox, another dye job. I'm nothing but committed. Gus, I would love to see that last one, I gotta tell you. Dr. Ann says, great episode with a great guest. I remember as a kid, I would always look for books that had strange guests or people I didn't know. This was pre-Who's Who. If you wanted to learn about the extended DC universe, you had to look for it. I am relatively sure I had encountered all the monsters on the cover before this issue, but I am sure I hadn't seen them a lot. Grundy, Man-Bat, the Demon. I am almost always certain this is the first time I saw Felix Faust in action. So this was amazing. But like you, Rob, I was a little disappointed that this wasn't the actual characters, instead people trapped in costume. As for Jimmy, he did indeed use the Wolfman potion in Jimmy Olsen number 44, viewed here, given the role Supergirl plays in the story. And then Ange provides a link back to his site, Comic Book's Commentary, where he talks about this very issue. And the kiss from Jaina isn't just for a bonus for saving the day. It is the cure to return Jimmy to normal. Because, of course, it is. Rob McCarthy says, I'm pretty sure Jason Blood's store sold demon costumes. A, it would really confuse people as to a secret ID. And B, a store can't stay in business selling spell books. You know, there's a series to be mined of the crazy infrastructure that has to be built up around a world with superheroes. I know there's, like, damage control and stuff like that, but I would love to know about stores that, like, just sell obscure DC hero costumes. Paul Kinzel, of course, from this very network, says, great episode as usual. Dr. Jennifer is a great guest and gives a very interesting perspective. I do recall this issue and also being disappointed that they were not the real characters. Jimmy Olsen, eh, but now I want to see the Aqua Rob pictures. Sorry, Paul. and then Rob McCarthy came back to say, I buy 70s Jimmy knocking out Felix Faust. All right, fair enough. Martin Gray says, me too. He was the hip-talking, fist-shaking Mr. Action. All right, we're getting things are getting a little out of hand, guys. And then Paul came back to say, P.S., Ramona Freyden Inc. by Vince Galletta is like saying a fine French wine mixed with mustard and topped with cream cheese. Sean M. Myers, who is, of course, Paul's co-host on Batman Family Reunion here on the Fire & Water Podcast Network, says, welcome to the podcast, Dr. Jen. You were a great guest. I'm one of the very few who was glad that the Super Friends weren't going against the real monster characters. By this time, I had read both the Demon and Man-Bat in Batman Family, so I was very happy that Man-Bat especially wasn't back to being a villain. I think so many people know of this issue because of that house ad you mentioned that featured the cover so prominently. There were only very few issues of Super Friends that had house ads. That's a good perspective, Sean. If you're a really big fan of Man-Bat, you don't want him to be a villain. So I can see that why you would think that way. Steve Given says, this is another great episode, Rob, but I'm writing mainly to thank Jennifer for her comments about the viability of comics as a literary medium. With working in public education as an English teacher for 16 years, I've met more than a few people who are willfully ignorant of the complexity that comics can attain and of what they can offer to students. Just a few weeks ago, a colleague said that graphic novels are lazy reading because of the visual element. This is a teacher struggling right now to be effective in her class, and I think her comments make it obvious why that is. Please excuse my catty excursion into Schadenfreude there. Anyway, I appreciate the affirmation from the good professor. And then Jennifer followed up with, thanks, Steve. I've never understood why comics are dismissed as a way to engage people, particularly kids, in reading. It's mind-boggling that those who deride comics as means of reading don't understand the concept of visual storytelling, and that reading happens in a variety of ways, not just printed words on a page. Going to dismount my soapbox now. Thank you for following up with that, Jennifer, and thank you, Steve. And yeah, I mean, comics was how I got into reading. I don't know why you would ever want to get in the way of that for any reason. Chuck Coletta leaves a comment. He says, another great episode with Jenny, who's becoming a Fire and Water regular contributor. I was especially interested in listening to your comments on teaching comics at college level. I also have a BA and MA degrees in literature, and I teach comics in nearly the same manner I would as any other writing. For example, this academic year I taught contemporary popular literature. We read such post-World War II authors as Arthur Miller, John Cheever, Amari Baraka, David Mamet, and more. Examining a comics text is not really that much different when all is said and done. The academic study of comic books and other popular culture, which we define as the culture of everyday life, is largely due to a great scholar named Dr. Ray Brown. He established our academic department and the BGSU Popular Culture Library in the late 60s with the intention that popular entertainments like comic books are worthy of our attention and examination. Next fall, I will be teaching my comic books, superheroes, and culture course once again, and it is lots of fun and hopefully informative. FYI, we are beginning to plan a Spider-Man and Popular Culture Conference in the fall 2023 semester. More info coming later this year. I'm currently looking for keynote speakers from the comics industry. If you have any ideas who we can get and afford, please let me know. Looking forward to hearing Jenny on another Fire and Water series. And then Jen came back to respond to Chuck. She says, hi, Chuck. I want to take that class. It sounds fabulous. Me too, Jenny. And I've said it before in other venues. I want to say it here. The BGSU Popular Culture Library is extraordinary. What a resource for everyone who loves pop culture. And you are also incredibly warm and welcoming. Hope a lot of the FNW listeners can find their way to Bowling Green at some point. It's a must see. Yeah, I would love to see that. And I would love to take Chuck's course. That's for damn sure. Chris Franklin from our network, of course, says, great show. It's always a pleasure to hear Jennifer on the network. As detailed, when Cindy and I covered that this issue on the Supermates House of Frankenstein a few years back, I coveted this issue for decades. I remember that house had with Kane announcing special Halloween issues, and I desperately wanted this comic, but I could never find it. When I did finally receive it as an adult, the Coletta inks and the fact that the actual monster characters weren't really in the story did let some air out of my balloon. But at least the story is a lot of fun, and the story is actually pretty good Coletta. I think he was inking with his hand, not his foot this time. It's a bit stiff, but acceptable. Jimmy's still kind of a big deal at the time. Yes, his comic had become Superman family, but he was still a headliner of his own solo series, something unfortunately not even Aquaman could always boast. Too soon, Chris. He was still running on the gas. Put in his popularity tank by Jack Larson's betrayal on The Adventures of Superman, still in heavy syndication. His popularity for 30 years is a bit of a head-scratcher now, though. Brian Linton says, I loved the pairing of Aquaman and Swamp Thing, two heroes who share mystical connections with different aspects of the natural world and seek to protect their respective domains. I believe there was a two-issue crossover between the two, sometime relatively early in the New 52 era, but I think there's a lot of additional story potential with this duo. Also, Rob, if you're looking for a live-action Bizarro, then I recommend his appearance in the second season of Superman and Lois on the CW. I am by no means an expert on the character, but I really enjoyed the show's portrayal of him. Finally, I am now officially shipping Jimmy and Jaina. Thanks for another amazing episode. He also followed up, Brian followed up, I checked and the Aquaman Swamp Thing teamed up in Aquaman 31 and Swamp Thing 32 of the New 52 runs. I think Shag and I covered that over on the Fire and Water podcast. It's been so long ago, I don't really remember, but I think we did. Itobos Nar says, I just wanted to second the recommendation on Bizarro and Superman and Lois. It's obviously a serious and darker take on the idea, but it's a really intriguing twist. In general, I've been pleasantly surprised how much I'm enjoying that show. Captain Entropy says, okay, first things first. Last night I told my wife I had to stay up a little longer to start writing this because I had to set the Fire and Water crew straight. She said he was sure that Rob and what's his butt, I can only assume she meant Shag, and that other guy, Chris, Siskoid, Ryan, no way to tell, were on it. She said she believed in you. I think she just wanted to go to bed. I was part of the clamoring mob that appealed to Shag over the JLA podcast to bring Dr. Jennifer Schwartz-Levine back, and I'm glad she's broadening her podcast horizons. She was a lot of fun here, just like she is there, and I add a hearty here to her points on comics as a storytelling medium. The two of you covered almost everything I had to say about this issue, except that one, Vince or no Vince, Ramona made everything look great, but especially Bruce and Dick's dates. And two, I'm with Rob McCarthy on 70s Jimmy Olsen knocking out Felix Faust. Mr. Action was John McClane, Nina Jones, and Nellie Bly rolled into one. Wow. I forgot to answer your question about costume parties. Yes, once in college, I was a vampire cowboy. Fun. Mitch Fletcher says, once more, another scintillating story for sure, for sure. Any chance there's a podcast that covers the Super Friends episodes? Maybe you guys could take a look at them after you finish the Super Friends comics series. Okay. Mitch, then they follow. Boston Moss says, that was fun as always. No merch this month. No, sorry, Boston. And he says, please note another vote for Mitch's idea on covering the TV episodes when the issues are done. Okay. About that, first of all, there is a podcast already out there hosted by John Drew, which covers the animated show. So that's ongoing, and that you can go listen to that there. And no, I will not be moving to that. I should just mention it now, since we are now well past the back nine of the Super Friends. We're past. My math is not my strong suit. We're at the back nine of the Super Friends. This show, this book ran, as I mentioned at the top of every episode, Super Friends ran 47 issues, which means we're going to be doing 47 episodes. I want to do one, you know, the one-to-one, that when you, you know, whatever issue, whatever episode number you look at, that's the issue number we're looking at. But 47 is a weird number. It was always annoyed me that the Super Friends didn't make it to 50. So this show, I will announce now, is going to run for 50 episodes. We're going to do three special shows to wrap up the series. And then For All Mankind will end with number 50. I'm sorry if that's kind of a bummer news. We're still like a full almost 2 years away from that. So there's lots of episodes to get to. But yeah, I mean, I have lots of ideas for other podcasts. And this thing was always meant to be a kind of limited run and complete it and go. And so that's what the plan is. Now, of course, with all my shows, it's a podcast. It never has to end forever. So you can always bring it back for special episodes if the occasion warrants. But generally the plan is For All Mankind will wrap up with number 50, just so you know, everybody. So, okay, let's get back to the comments. Martin Gray comes back and he says, cheers for another fun-filled listen. And yes, it's great to have Jenny on the show. I made a note that this issue of Super Friends features my favorite cover ever. And then Rob says the exact same thing. And Jenny too. Does anyone not love this? What a detailed image. Ramona didn't have to put the little music man at the bottom, but she did, and it makes a good cover even better. The story was pure fun, a typically entertaining imaginative romp, confirming once more that the Super Friends were in the regular DCU, despite Batman's refusal to go off-brand and bring in the rest of the JLA. Bob Smith was missed, but Vince Coletta did a decent job. I wonder if he was responsible for the rich black inks that had Swampy looking so authentic to his 70s self. I've only been to one costume party. I was the Invisible Man. You probably can't see. That's an Ange-level joke, Martin. And then he says, Jenny's mention of the spinner rack carousel here in the UK reminds me. There should be a comics podcast simply called Spinner Rack, perhaps dealing with random issues. Breakout Siskoid's Randomizer. If only someone at the Foreign Wonder Network had their very own Spinner Rack. I mean, we did do an episode of FW Presents with me and Derek William Crabb all about spinner racks, because he owns one as well. It's not exactly what you're talking about, Martin, but we did at least do that. And, you know, it's not the worst idea in the world, although I will say a good chunk of my spinner rack is taken up with Mountain Comics, and that, of course, has its own show, too. So, by the way, regarding the inks, the shadows on the Swamp Thing, I mean, it's generally the work of the penciler, the responsibility of the penciler to spot the blacks, not spot the blacks, to indicate the blacks, which you would generally do with a little X. You would put a little space in any given panel and just put an X there, and that's the indication to the inker, fill this in with black. The inker can go off script, as it were, and do more, do less, but that's generally how it works. So any of the deep shadows is probably the work of Ramona Freyden. And then speaking of Derek William Crabb, he comments, he says, the anti-monitor is lucky Jimmy Olsen and Glee can never combine their forces. Yes, I mean, really, when you think about it, they took out, collectively, they took out the Time Trapper and Felix Faust. That's pretty good. Captain Entropy also says, exactly, when the Science Council labels me a crackpot, I'll tell them Derek Crabb gets it. Ada Bosnar returns. Everybody left multiple comments this month. Oh, yeah, great show. And it seems like For All Mankind always has such a high caliber of guests. And yes, the coverage of this issue was definitely the best of the series. Also, regardless of what I think of as of Coletta's inks, like I said over in the comments of the latest Treasury cast, I sometimes defend his work. But as with that Legion story, he didn't do Freyden's work any favors here. And yes, I could so relate to Rob recounting how his spirits fell when he opened a comic as a kid and saw that Coletta was the inker. As for the costume party question, yes, I've been to a few, but mostly dressed in civilian garb. The one time I didn't was in college when a friend and I dressed as Smurfs. Interesting story, too. We drove to the party in a big Chevy Monte Carlo. We Smurfs were in the front, and another friend dressed as Elvis was sitting in the back. We got a lot of amused and approving smiles from people in other cars at every stoplight. Man, I guess it was like you were chaperoning or chauffeuring Elvis around. It was kind of fun. And then finally, the last comment is from Brett Young. He says, I distinctly remember this issue as a kid because I snatched it off the spinner rack the second I saw the cover. I've always been a sucker for hero-villain face-off covers. Yeah, me too. But My favorite is the Strange Sports Stories cover with the good guys facing the bad guys at a baseball game. But this Super Friends cover is up there as well. It was probably the first time I'd seen Etrigan in his ridiculous costume. I appreciate Felix Faust taking artistic license to alliterate all his commands to kill the various Super Friends. When you're a dark arts evildoer, you gotta have fun when you can. Speaking of Faust, he's frightened by a cat with bat wings and a nice skeleton so badly he sets himself up to be Will Smith, Jimmy Olsen. His co-workers are hell demons and ghouls. Come on, Faust, you're better than this. Is he? Is he, Brett? Anyway, that's going to do it for the comments. Thanks, everybody. That was a bunch of really fun comments on the last episode of For All Mankind. So that's just great. I love how much commentary the show gets. I really do appreciate it. And keep them coming, everybody. Big thanks to Scott X, my pal, for coming back to the network and coming on this show, making his debut appearance on For All Mankind. And you can look for him on other shows on the Fire and Water Podcast Network, and I guarantee he'll be making other appearances in the future. So that's going to do it. Of course, if you want to find back episodes of the show, go to the website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to the show on any podcatcher of your choice. We're always talking Super Friends over on Twitter at @ForAllMankindSF. And then finally, if you want to support the Fire and Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FWPodcast. There you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So big thanks to Chuck Dill, Stanford and Brown, Gord Tolton, and David Escutieres for their support of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I really appreciate it. So as I said, that's going to do it. Thanks for listening to For All Mankind. Join us next episode when we look at Super Friends number 30, Guerrilla Warfare Against the Humans.
An FWTV podcast.